content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the January 2023 edition of Education Today. We'll get started with an article from BBC News titled, University Staff Plan 18 New Days of Strikes. A wave of 18 new strike days are planned across 150 UK universities in February and March, the University and College Union has announced. It said a pay offer worth between 4 to 5% made during talks with employers this week was not enough. But UCEA, which represents university employers, says the offer made is worth up to 7%. UCU General Secretary Dr. Joe Grady said the clock is now ticking for a deal to be reached. It comes after the government announced tuition fees in England will be frozen for another 2 years. Today, our union came together to back an unprecedented program of escalating strike action. The clock is now ticking for the sector to produce a deal or be hit with widespread disruption throughout spring, said Dr. Grady. University employers, the Universities and Colleges Employers Association, UCEA, say the offer on the table recognizes that cost of living pressures fall disproportionately on the lower paid staff. UCEA Chief Executive Raj Jethwa said a proportion of the award on offer was being offered from February. This is 6 months early as a direct response to current cost of living concerns, he said. UCEA said its offer would mean an increase of up to 7%, with a minimum of 5% for anyone earning up to £51,000. The fact that UCU is not calling indefinite strike action is welcome, but their revised strike plans could still have a damaging impact on students. UCU needs to provide its members with a realistic and fair assessment of what is achievable, Mr. Jethwa said. The UCU said it would confirm the precise dates of strike action by the 70,000 academics and university support staff next week. As part of the stepping up of its industrial action, the union also said it would re-ballot members. That would allow it to comply with the law on industrial disputes and open the way for it to call more strikes later in the year. And we'll cut that article short for time. The next article comes from USA Today, and it's titled, Congress Got Rid of a Free Lunch for All Program. That means some students are going hungry. Key points. Students are back to racking up lunch debt this school year after federal legislation that provided free meals to all students expired. With free meals for all gone, participation in school meal programs has dropped by 23%, according to federal data. And schools have accrued more than $19 million in unpaid meal debt, according to a new survey from the School Nutrition Association. Advocates worry kids are going hungry at school as meal prices increase and because they have had to resume filling out applications for free or subsidized meals. They want the federal government to do more. As schools around the country reopen after winter break, their students are being reminded of the lunch debt they've racked up this school year. An ugly reality that follows the end of federal assistance that paid for school meals for more than 50 million students during the pandemic. Congress ended the Free Lunch for All program in June, reverting to a system in which low-income families had to fill out paperwork to qualify for aid based on their income. But some families have been left behind because they do not understand the application process, and others are rejected because they do not qualify. A family of four must earn about $36,000 a year or less to qualify for free lunch. Schools often feed these students, requiring them to pay later and creating a debt many families cannot pay down. For some children, the debt can get so big that schools stop giving them a full meal. Community organizations, social media influencers, and national nonprofits are trying to help fill the void with donations to cover the more than $19 million in debt students have accrued just halfway into the school year. It doesn't seem to be enough. Plenty of kids face going without school lunches or getting smaller alternative school meals when they return to school this winter because of their negative balances. This is happening at a time of historic inflation when school meal prices are rising and many families are struggling to pay rent and feed their children. How much school lunch debt is there? Results from a national survey by the School Nutrition Association, published Wednesday, shows 847 schools had amassed $19.2 million in lunch debt. Debt varies across the country. Across North Carolina, lunch debt exceeded $1 million as of November 1st. One Wisconsin school district surpassed $14,000 in school lunch debt by October, And in Georgia, a nonprofit called All for Lunch paid $130,000 to wipe the debt of several schools across several metro area counties in December. Why does it matter? Universal school meals can promote academic achievement, keep kids healthier, and reduce lunch shaming of students who have unpaid meal debt and can't afford their lunch, said Diane Pratt-Hevener, a spokeswoman for the National School Nutrition Association. According to the national campaign No Kid Hungry, run by the nonprofit Share Our Strength, students who eat school breakfast have been shown to achieve 17.5% higher scores on standardized math tests and attend 1.5 more days of school per year on average. Who is trying to help? Several community groups and even social media influencers are donating to help schools cover students' debt and supporting initiatives that could lead to policy change. The nonprofit Tusk Philanthropies Solving Hunger is funding four organizations focused on promoting policy change related to universal free healthy school meals. The organization is funding campaigns in Connecticut, New York, North Carolina, and Vermont. In another, Sarah Stusik recorded herself calling Mount Vernon Community School in a viral TikTok video to pay off the Virginia school's nearly $1,700 lunch debt. It's wonderful Sarah is doing that and that so many community organizations have stepped up to help address this, the School Nutrition Association's Pratt-Hevener said. But it's unfortunately a short-term solution and one of the reasons Congress should provide school lunches. In recent years, new state legislation has emerged to ban lunch shaming, preventing schools from feeding kids who can't pay or have with debt smaller alternative meals, thereby broadcasting that they haven't paid up. Which states offer free meals to kids? Some states opted to continue free lunch for all programs, including Massachusetts, Nevada, Vermont, and Pennsylvania. California, Maine, and now Colorado are the only states with laws ensuring permanent universal meal programs for all children, regardless of parents' income. A few districts, including in Chicago and New York City, also offer free meals to kids. What other meal problems are schools experiencing? Kids are accruing debt in part because schools are having a hard time getting kids to sign up for the federal free and reduced price school lunch program. Some children don't qualify, but still can't afford meals. A survey by the National Center for Education Statistics shows student participation in school meal programs is down from last school year by 23% nationally. The largest drop is in the Midwest at 31%. The October survey shows that of the 88% of schools that operate USDA school lunch and breakfast meal programs, 1 in 4 reported it was much more or a little more difficult for their school to operate meal programs this school year compared with last. Schools told the School Nutrition Association increasing costs, staff shortages, menu item shortages, menu items being discontinued, and unpaid meal debt are some of their top challenges. The next article comes from NBC News, and it's titled, Judge Rules Against LGBTQ Students in Title IX College Discrimination Suit. A federal judge sided with religiously affiliated universities in a case where LGBTQ students alleged Title IX exemptions allowed them to face discrimination. A federal judge dismissed on Thursday a lawsuit filed by LGBTQ students who allege the Department of Education doesn't protect them against discrimination from more than 24 religiously affiliated universities that receive federal funding. Last year, the group of current and former college students filed the suit in an attempt to challenge the religious exemptions granted under Title IX of the Education Amendment of 1972, which prohibits sex-based discrimination in educational programs or activities that receive federal funds. The plaintiffs alleged that, by design, the exemptions permit religiously affiliated institutions to discriminate against students on the basis of sex, sexual orientation, and gender identity. Judge Ann Aiken of the U.S. District Court for the District of Oregon, Eugene Division, an appointee of former President Bill Clinton, wrote in her decision that the students sufficiently alleged that the exemptions permit religiously affiliated schools to use religious exemptions to deny federally funded educational services to current and prospective students. However, Aiken added, the students did not prove Congress's intent behind the exemptions and dismissed the case. plaintiffs have submitted no allegations of discriminatory motivation on the part of those enacting the religious exemption, she wrote in her decision. To the contrary, plaintiffs argue that when Congress enacted Title IX, protections for or discrimination against sexual and gender minorities were of, quote, no concern. Alliance Defending Freedom, the conservative legal advocacy group representing the religiously affiliated universities, celebrated the judge's decision, stating that the Title IX exemptions protect, quote, the freedom of religious schools to live out their deeply and sincerely held convictions. A group of activists asked the court to strip that protection away from schools that educate the next generation and advance the common good, David Cortman, an attorney for ADF, said in a statement Thursday. The court correctly concluded that Title IX's religious liberty exemption doesn't violate any of the plaintiff's claimed rights. The legal group representing the students, the Religious Exemptions Accountability Project, slammed the judge's ruling and said it was considering whether to appeal. Because of today's decision, tens of thousands of LGBTQIA+ students across the country will continue to be discriminated against at universities receiving taxpayer money, the group said in a statement Friday. Some of the plaintiffs alleged they were denied admission to or expelled from the religiously affiliated universities because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. Others claimed the institution subjected them to the discredited practice of conversion therapy. Veronica Bonifacio Penales, a senior at Baylor University who was part of the lawsuit, said the decision feels like a slap in the face. "Obviously, the fight doesn't stop here," she said. "We're not even going to let this deter us. If anything, this is going to push us to work a little bit harder." A representative for the Department of Education did not immediately respond to NBC News' request for comment regarding the judge's decision. The next article comes from the New York Times, and it's titled, "A Lecturer Showed a Painting of the Prophet Muhammad. She Lost Her Job." After an outcry over the art history class by Muslim students, Hamline University officials said the incident was Islamophobic. But many scholars say the work is a masterpiece. Erica Lopez Prater, an adjunct professor at Hamline University, said she knew many Muslims have deeply held religious beliefs that prohibit depictions of the Prophet Muhammad. So last semester for a global art history class, she took many precautions before showing a 14th century painting of Islam's founder. In the syllabus, she warned that images of holy figures, including the Prophet Muhammad and the Buddha, would be shown in the course. She asked students to contact her with any concerns, and she said no one did. In class, she prepped students, telling them that in a few minutes, the painting would be displayed in case anyone wanted to leave. Then Dr. Lopez Prater showed the image and lost her teaching gig. Officials at Hamline, a small private university in St. Paul, Minnesota, with about 1,800 graduates, had tried to douse what they feared would become a runaway fire. Instead, they ended up with what they had tried to avoid, a national controversy which pitted advocates of academic liberty and free speech against Muslims who believe that showing the image of Prophet Muhammad is always sacrilegious. After Dr. Lopez Prater showed the image, a senior in the class complained to the administration. Other Muslim students not in the course supported the student, saying the class was an attack on their religion. They demanded that officials take action. Officials told Dr. Lopez Prater that her services next semester were no longer needed. In emails to students and faculty, they said that the incident was clearly Islamophobic. Hamline's president, Fainis S. Miller, co-signed an email that said respect for the Muslim students should have superseded academic freedom. At a town hall, an invited Muslim speaker compared showing the images to teaching that Hitler was good. Free speech supporters started their own campaign. An Islamic art historian wrote an essay defending Dr. Lopez Prater and started a petition demanding the university's board investigate the matter. It had more than 2,800 signatures. Free speech groups and publications issued blistering critiques. Pan America called it one of the most egregious violations of academic freedom in recent memory, and Muslims themselves debated whether the action was Islamophobic. Arguments over academic freedom have been fought on campuses for years, but they can be especially fraught at small private colleges like Hamline, which are facing shrinking enrollment and growing financial pressures. To attract applicants, many of these colleges have diversified their curriculums and tried to be more welcoming to students who have been historically shut out of higher education. Meanwhile, professors everywhere often face pushback for their academic decisions from activist students or conservative lawmakers. Dr. Lopez Prater's situation was especially precarious. She is an adjunct, one of higher education's underclass of teachers, working for little pay and receiving few of the workplace protections enjoyed by tenured faculty members. University officials and administrators all declined interviews. But Dr. Miller, the school's president, defended the decision in a statement. "To look upon an image of the Prophet Muhammad for many Muslims is against their faith," Dr. Miller's statement said, adding, "It was important that our Muslim students, as well as all other students, feel safe, supported, and respected both in and out of our classrooms." In a December interview with the school newspaper, the student who complained to the administration, Aram Wadatala, described being blindsided by the image. "I'm like, this can't be real," said Ms. Wadatala, who in a public forum described herself as Sudanese. "As a Muslim and a black person, I don't feel like I belong, and I don't think I'll ever belong in a community where they don't value me as a member, and they don't show the same respect that I show them." Todd H. Green, who has written books about Islamophobia, said the conflict at Hamline was tragic because administrators pitted natural allies, those concerned about stereotypes of Muslims and Islam, against one another. The administration, he said, closed down conversation when they should have opened it up. The image. The painting shown in Dr. Lopez Prater's class is in one of the earliest Islamic illustrated histories of the world, a compendium of chronicles, written during the 14th century by Rashid al-Din, 1247 to 1318. Shown regularly in art history classes, the painting shows a winged and crowned angel Gabriel pointing at the Prophet Muhammad and delivering to him the first Quranic revelation. Muslims believe that the Quran comprises the words of Allah revealed to the Prophet Muhammad through the angel Gabriel. "The image is a masterpiece of Persian manuscript painting," said Christiane Gruber, a professor of Islamic art at the University of Michigan. "It is housed at the University of Edinburgh. Similar paintings have been on display at places like the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and a sculpture of the Prophet is at the Supreme Court." Dr. Gruber said that showing Islamic art and depictions of the Prophet Muhammad have become more common in academia because of a push to decolonize the canon, that is, expand curriculum beyond a Western model. Dr. Gruber, who wrote the essay in New Lines magazine defending Dr. Lopez Prater, said that studying Islamic art without the Compendium of Chronicles image would be like not teaching Michelangelo's David. Yet, most Muslims believe that visual representations of Muhammad should not be viewed, even if the Quran does not explicitly prohibit them. The prohibition stems from the belief that an image of Muhammad could lead to worshipping the Prophet rather than the God he served. There are, however, a range of beliefs. Some Muslims distinguish between respectful depictions and mocking caricatures, while others do not subscribe to the restriction at all. Omid Safi, a professor of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Duke University, said he regularly shows images of the Prophet Muhammad in class and without Dr. Lopez Prater's opt-out mechanisms. He explains to his students that these images were works of devotion created by pious artists at the behest of devout rulers. "That's the part I want my students to grapple with," Dr. Safi said. "How does something that comes from the very middle of the tradition end up being received later on as something marginal or forbidden?" A warning, and then the image. Dr. Lopez Prater, a self-described art nerd, said she knew about the potential for conflict on October 6th when she began her online lecture with 30 or so students. She said she spent a few minutes explaining why she was showing the image, how different religions have depicted the divine, and how standards change over time. "I do not want to present the art of Islam as something that is monolithic," she said in an interview, adding that she had been shown the image as a graduate student. She also showed a second image from the 16th century, which depicted Muhammad wearing a veil. Dr. Lopez Prater said that no one in class raised concerns, and there was no disrespectful commentary. After the class ended, Ms. Wadatala, a business major and president of the university's Muslim Student Association, stuck around to voice her discomfort. Immediately afterward, Dr. Lopez Prater sent an email to her department head, Allison Baker, about the encounter. She thought that Ms. Wadatala might complain. Ms. Baker, the chair of the Digital and Studio Art Department, responded to the email 4 minutes later. "It sounded like you did everything right," Ms. Baker said. "I believe in academic freedom, so you have my support." As Dr. Lopez Prater predicted, Ms. Batatala reached out to administrators. Dr. Lopez Prater, with Ms. Baker's help, wrote an apology explaining that sometimes diversity involves bringing contradicting, uncomfortable, and coexisting truths into conversation with each other. Ms. Batatala declined an interview request and did not explain why she had not raised concerns before the image was shown. But in an email statement, she said images of Prophet Muhammad should never be displayed, and that Dr. Lopez Prater gave a trigger warning precisely because she knew such images were offensive to many Muslims. The lecture was so disturbing, she said, that she could no longer see herself in that course. 4 days after the class, Dr. Lopez Prater was summoned to a video meeting with the Dean of the College of Liberal Arts, Marcela Costehova. Dr. Costehova compared showing the image to using a racial epithet for black people, according to Dr. Lopez Prater. "It was very clear to me that she had not talked to any art historians," Dr. Lopez Prater said. A couple of weeks later, the university rescinded its offer to teach next semester. Dr. Lopez Prater said she was ready to move on. She had teaching jobs at other schools. But on November 7th, David Everett, the Vice President for Inclusive Excellence, sent an email to all university employees saying that certain actions taken in an online class were undeniably inconsiderate, disrespectful, and Islamophobic. The administration, after meeting with the school's Muslim Student Association, would host an open forum on the subject of Islamophobia, he wrote. Dr. Lopez Prater, who had only begun teaching at Hamline in the fall, said she felt like a bucket of ice water had been dumped over her head, but the shock soon gave way to blistering anger at being characterized in those terms by somebody who I have never even met or spoken with. She reached out to Dr. Gruber, who ended up writing the essay and starting the petition. An emotional forum. At the December 8th forum, which was attended by several dozen students, faculty, and administrators, Ms. Batatala described, often through tears, how she felt seeing the image. "Who do I call at 8 a.m., she asked, when you see someone disrespecting and offending your religion?" Other Muslim students on the panel, all black women, also spoke tearfully about struggling to fit in at Hamline. Students of color in recent years had protested what they called racist incidents. The university, they said, paid lip service to diversity and did not support students with institutional resources. The main speaker was Jaylani Hussein, the executive director of the Minnesota chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, a Muslim civil rights group. The instructor's actions, he said, hurt Muslim students and students of color and had absolutely no benefit. "If this institution wants to value those students," he added, "it cannot have incidents like this happen. If somebody wants to teach some controversial stuff about Islam, go teach it at the local library." Mark Berkson, a religion professor at Hamline, raised his hand. "When you say trust Muslims on Islamophobia," Dr. Berkson asked, "what does one do when the Islamic community itself is divided on an issue? Because there are many Muslim scholars and experts and art historians who do not believe that this was Islamophobic." Mr. Hussein responded that there were marginal and extremist voices on any issue. "You can teach a whole class about why Hitler was good," Mr. Hussein said. During the exchange, Ms. Baker, the department head, and Dr. Everett, the administrator, separately walked up to the religion professor, put their hands on his shoulders, and said this was not the time to raise these concerns, Dr. Berkson said in an interview. But Dr. Berkson, who said he strongly supported campus diversity, said that he felt compelled to speak up. "We were being asked to accept without questioning that what our colleague did, teaching an Islamic art masterpiece in a class on art history after having given multiple warnings, was somehow equivalent to mosque vandalism and violence against Muslims and hate speech," Dr. Berkson said. "That is what I could not stand." And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from U.S. News, and it's titled, "Biden Administration Proposes New Rules to Ease Student Debt Burden." Proposed new rules would set a higher income threshold for repayment requirements and reduce payments for low- and middle-income student borrowers. Amid an ongoing court battle to lower or cancel student debt, the Biden administration is using its regulatory authority to reduce the debt burden for low- and middle-income students, according to administration officials. Under the proposed new rules, which would have to go through the regulatory process, individuals making $30,500 a year, meaning those making $15 an hour, would not have to make monthly payments on their federal student loans. The most generous programs now for borrowers in an income-driven repayment plan max out at $20,400 annual income for a single individual, officials said. Further, federal loan borrowers would need to pay a maximum of just 5% of their discretionary income for monthly undergraduate loan repayments, about half the rate typically charged now, the administration said in a fact sheet explaining the new rules. The maximum for graduate student loans would remain at 10% of discretionary income under the current Revised Pay-as-You-Earn, or REPAYE, repay plan. The new rules would be amendments to the repay plan, so the administration is moving to change the terms through the regulatory process. That does not mean the rules will be finalized or that they will not be challenged in court, as President Joe Biden's student loan cancellation program has been. Student debt has become a dream killer, Education Secretary Miguel Cardona told reporters in a conference call Monday evening. It threatens Americans' ability to compete globally, keeping college graduates from buying a home, starting a business, or having a family, he said, adding that before the pandemic, more than 1 million borrowers defaulted on their student loans each year. The proposed rules would also pare down the crippling interest payments of some borrowers. Currently, the Education Department estimates up to 70% of borrowers on income-driven repayment plans see their debt balances grow even as they are paying off their loans, since they can only afford a monthly payment that is less than the accrued interest. That means the principal remains and the interest continues to accumulate. Under the proposed new rules, any payment would first be applied to the interest, but any additional interest would not be charged. The new rules would also limit lifetime payments for eligible borrowers. The shortened path to loan forgiveness would be especially helpful to low- and middle-income borrowers, community college students, and borrowers who work in public service, the Education Department said. And we'll cut that article short for time. And we'll read a quick excerpt from an article from Education Week titled, "The School Shooting Incidents Nobody Hears About." Were it not for the young age of the shooter, a recent Virginia incident, in which police say a 6-year-old boy shot and wounded his teacher, would not have made national news, a researcher who tracks gun violence in schools said. While the January 6th shooting in a Newport News elementary school classroom has fueled needed conversations about student safety and responsible gun storage, incidents of a similar scale happen regularly, and they too often go unnoticed, said David Reedman, who independently tracks when guns are fired or brandished on school grounds. This plays out hundreds of times a year, Reedman said, as police released more details about the Newport News shooting. This is just one of the rare times anyone knows about it. And we'll cut that article short for time. We've run out of time for this episode of Education Today. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Education Today is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.